Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tieni from Tetani of Dakota, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Ya koe, no ia e Māori, aloha kākou, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and today on the show, the impacts of El Nino is spreading across the highlands of Papua New Guinea.
If it continues, or the kids might lose life, or we might have affected by disease.
Could the untapped gas fields in PNG change the way energy is supplied?
To have a source that's in the Asia-Pacific region, which is a stable region, it's a region at peace, is very attractive. So that will help this project.
And it's election day today in the Cook Islands. Stay tuned for those stories and more right here on Pacific Beat, where we come to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Ngā mihi. Thank you for spending your morning with us here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with destroyed crops, hungry children and empty schools. That is the impact of El Nino and is spreading across the highlands of Papua New Guinea. It's not only homes that are feeling it. One of the country's biggest gold mines in Pogara has suspended processing due to low water levels. As Natasha Emick reports, the worst is yet to come, with El Nino expected to reach its peak in the coming months.
For the past 3 months, the people of Komia village in the southern highlands have been battling both drought and frosts.
If it continues, the kids might lose life, or we might have affected by disease.
Community leader Mark Hanna has been documenting the damage brought on by El Nino. He says the large river that once supplied the whole community is now reduced to rocks and puddles. What little water remains is being shared by everyone for drinking, cooking and washing dishes.
The water itself is not helped because the entire population is accessing the same very low flow of the water. It contains a lot of dirt because they're accessing it for washing dishes and so forth. So it's not healthy at the moment.
With water this scarce, even basic hygiene has become a luxury.
We are lucky only we are using it for drinking and cooking. So most challenges is like we are having health issues because we are using dirty bearings, clothes are dirty. We are not having but producing a smell in our bodies.
The local school has cut classes to just 4 hours a day, ending at midday, so children can spend the afternoon searching for water now. And there is little food waiting for them at home. The frost that followed the drought has destroyed village gardens.
Well, the gardens, it's like a fire. It's like a bushfire. It turned into brown, so we have no food at all. So after the drought and after frost, it had a garden food. It's like a desert, so we have no access to any more food.
He says many families earn their money by selling food from their gardens and fish from local fisheries. With that income now gone, they're struggling to afford food elsewhere, and many are going hungry.
The government currently are not able to at least pump some relief funds, so we are still waiting and kids will be suffering. Many old people might die, so be.
On the other side of the province, in Umbongo, fish farmer James Angel says he has never seen a drought this bad.
This is the worst one that I've seen. So El Nino came and dried up that pond. So I got rid of all that 25 or 24,000 fish. And that is the effect of it. So now I don't have any more fish.
He was forced to give away what he couldn't sell, taking a loss.
30,000 to 40,000 kina worth got lost. Well, there's no one to cry to, so I'm just sitting here.
In PNG's Western Highlands region, Pogara Gold Mine has halted processing because of the low water levels in Wally Creek Dam. Resident Ileja Pairapu says water supplies in nearby Payam are also running low.
But those people who are living in Payam town are able to access the water supply that has been fed by Palipaka River, which is also getting low.
He says food prices are rising, while tribal fighting has left many people reliant on supplies from outside of Porgera, making food security increasingly vulnerable.
If Hagen farmers are not able to supply the food in Porgera, then we Porgera will really feel the pinch of this thing. But the threat is already there. We can see it. Prices of cows have risen, and even prices of rice bag and all these things have risen.
But the hard days appear far from over.
The peak of the El Nino condition could be around September, October.
That's Dr. Kacheng Wongsatha Ponchai, who heads the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization in PNG. He says the timing of this El Nino could make things a lot more difficult for farmers than previous years, because the peak is set to hit during the months when PNG would normally get a lot of rain.
So we also do have to understand that the impact of El Nino on food and agriculture also depends on how the drought will affect the cropping season. And this one seems to be also very, very bad as well.
There are also serious concerns about the impact on health services. In Simbu province, public health facilities have scaled down due to a lack of water and only providing emergency care after 2 p.m.
We are extremely challenged for providing patient care in our facilities and at the same time providing good welfare for our staffs. The common denominator is water.
Dr. Kasi Ken heads the Simbu Provincial Health Authority. He says many other Highlands hospitals are facing similar struggles and also considering scaling back their services, and like them, are doing what they can to get by.
We get the big 9,000 liter tanks and put them at the back of the big trucks, go down and they will get water and then they will come uphill again. So that's what we are doing now to sustain us in this El Nino period.
And that is Dr. Kasi Ken from the Simbu Provincial Health Authority, ending that report from Natasha Emick. All right, war in the Middle East is continuing to force countries to look for alternative energy supplies. And oil and gas giants are eyeing off a multi-billion dollar LNG stockpile on Australia's doorstep. The gas field in Papua New Guinea's Gulf province contains the energy equivalent of more than 1 billion barrels of oil. But for two decades, it's remained untapped. PNG correspondent Marion Farr takes a look at whether that could all be about to change.
Joseph Irai is a landowner from the Pirari Delta of PNG's Gulf Province, a vast landscape of serpentine rivers and rich mangrove forests. For his people, the environment is life.
We survive from it, we learn from it, we live with it, and when we die, we go back to the land.
But 20 years ago, a huge natural gas deposit was discovered around his home. The Elk Antelope Field contains the energy equivalent of 1 billion barrels of oil. Professor Stephen Howes is an economist who's been tracking plans to develop the site known as Papua LNG, plans that have never quite eventuated.
You can list a number of separate reasons for delay: change of government, COVID, higher construction costs.
Oil and gas giants behind the project, Total Energies, ExxonMobil and Santos, have been growing frustrated with the delays. But things could be about to change. War in the Middle East has sent consumers looking for new sources of LNG.
So to have a source in the Asia-Pacific region, which is a stable region, it's a region at peace, is very attractive. So that will help this project.
PNG, a resource-dependent nation sometimes referred to as the Saudi Arabia of the Pacific, needs the economic stimulus from Papua LNG.
PNG has gone without a new resource project.
But not everyone is confident in its future. Kevin Morrison is a market analyst with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. 3 years ago, he was warning of an LNG glut and said the project could be financially risky. While he agrees things have changed due to conflict in the Middle East, he says the market is still poised to grow.
There's so much gas coming onto the market. It's the biggest increase in LNG supply that the market has ever seen.
Papua LNG's proponents still haven't announced a single buyer.
Normally they have these signed agreements, but for this one, there hasn't been anything signed. So it's just uncertain about where this gas will go.
The project also needs to secure financial backing. Nearly 30 financial institutions have backed away from the project after a group of NGOs alleged the project violates the Equator Principles, a globally recognised benchmark for financial institutions to assess environmental and social risks. The complaint raised human rights, biodiversity, climate and transparency concerns. Total Energy says it's committed to respecting the Equator Principles and is working closely with authorities and local communities to make sure the project exceeds social and environmental standards. But landowners like Joseph Irai want greater assurances.
The consultation, people heard it, but not really absorbed into them that they really understand the impact.
He says while people want the benefits that will flow, his community still doesn't know enough to agree to the project.
It has to be understood by the people before we can give away or agree to it.
And that is Joseph Irai ending that report from Marion Farr and PNG.
Pacific Beat.
All right, the Pacific's fisheries scientists are meeting in Samoa this week to grapple with the future of the world's largest tuna fishery. Delegates from 26 countries and territories are in Apia for the 22nd Scientific Committee session of the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission. At the meeting's opening, Samoa's Prime Minister told delegates, "What you decide in this hall in coming days will be felt in coastal villages long before it is felt in any capital." So to find out what will be discussed and decided, I am joined now by Commission's Executive Director, Rhea Moss-Christian. With that, good morning, Rhea, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
Rhea, what is the key focus of this year's meeting?
Well, this year is, again, a heavy agenda, but we are looking at updated stock assessments for the big eye stock and the yellowfin tuna stocks. We are also reviewing updated assessments for Pacific bluefin and North Pacific albacore.
Would love to know, what role does the scientific committee actually play for the commission then?
Well, the scientific committee is the first of the series of meetings that WCPFC holds each year. And there's a reason for that. It's really important for members to review all of the most recent data, which is data for 2025, and to understand how anything might have changed, environmental conditions, any stock behaviors. There are always a number of research projects ongoing throughout every year. So this is the opportunity for scientists and some managers to look at what is the latest science telling us and then formulate recommendations that then move forward to the commission meeting in December.
Mm. And I understand, Rhea, when you talk about data, there is often data gaps that the Pacific struggles with, right? So I'm just wondering, what are some of the gaps that, again, your scientific committee is working on when it comes to the Pacific's fisheries?
Yeah, most of the gaps are at the moment in the longline fishery, where monitoring coverage remains quite low. And so these are gaps in understanding impacts on bycatch species like sea turtles, certain shark species, mantas, but also some of the targeted species for longline vessels, which is generally big eye and yellowfin tuna. So this meeting provides scientists an opportunity to, again, to understand what those gaps are, to look at options and opportunities to improve data availability, and then again, to formulate the right recommendations to inform managers.
Mm. This year is, of course, the 22nd Scientific Committee session. Rhea, what progress do you think has been made since the last one, though?
Well, there's only so much progress that can be made year to year. I think what we need to look at is the cumulative improvements in scientific data and the availability of that information, but importantly, understanding how things are changing in the environment and how stock behavior is changing. We won't learn as much year to year, for example, or in 1 year as we would across several years of looking at that same data and understanding those changes. So from last year to this year, we of course have more data. We get more data each year to look at, and the research projects have advanced. But we're looking at an accumulation of information over time.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, I know Samoa's Prime Minister told delegates, you know, what you decide in this hall in coming days will be felt in coastal villages long before it's felt in any capital. Could you maybe explain what do you think he meant by that?
Well, I think he's referring to the importance of this work to livelihoods, coastal communities, those who are relying on the health of these stocks, and probably alluding to the changes that people who live in concert with the ocean feel long before the scientists look at data. I mean, we're considering things like climate change impacts. We're looking at any, as I said, changes in behavior in stocks and what might be driving those. And I think we know that people in our coastal communities really have those deep understandings and connections with the environment and see those long before the scientists come to a meeting to consider data on paper. Mm-hmm. So I think the Prime Minister was really alluding to how important it is to remember that there are lots of communities and livelihoods that depend on the work of this organization.
How do you think then that responsibility factor or factors into the decisions that are going to be made at this committee?
I think they factor in all of the decisions. This organization is made up primarily of small island developing states and territories, and these representatives have a deep understanding of how important this work is. And so it's not just looking at data on paper, like I said earlier, but it's really about thinking, what are the impacts of the decisions and the recommendations that we're making? What is the science telling us? When do we need to be cautious? How do we ensure that the decisions that are made by managers in December are based on the best available science?
Yeah, Ria, you talk about impacts, you talk about the science behind it, but for yourself, though, what is the key issue you are hoping can be hashed out or even maybe resolved at this year's meeting?
Well, we really need to get on top of the data gaps. We really need to have strong recommendations that will provide managers with what they need, what the information they need from scientists to make those tough decisions about increasing monitoring coverage in the long-line fleet, for example, about advancing and accelerating development of electronic monitoring. It's really ensuring that the managers have what they need to make the important decisions to ensure that all of the conservation and management measures are underpinned by strong data.
Well, look, Ria, we really do appreciate you coming on the show this morning and sharing all the best with the remainder of the meeting that is happening there in Samoa.
All right. Thanks very much.
And that, of course, is Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission's Executive Director, Ria Moss Christian.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursdays at 4 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Vinaka Vakalevu and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now to Samoa, where buses and taxis are a popular mode of transport with thousands of people using public transport every day. But the sharp increase in fuel prices in recent months means drivers have been doing it tough and they've had to absorb the extra cost, unable to pass it on to customers. Well, to ease the pressure on public transport operators, the government approved a 30% increase in bus and taxi fares. Passengers say the increase is too much and too sudden, but drivers say it's fair and necessary. Samoa reporter Adele Fruin has the story.
On the streets of Apia, there's a mixed reaction to the 30% increase to bus and taxi fares that came into effect at the start of the month.
I don't agree with the increase in bus fares. It's because some of us who are barely surviving with various financial commitments now have to cope with this sudden increase. Now we just work to be able to pay bus fares, even sacrificing not eating, but just saving money for transportation.
The disadvantage on us to use the taxis daily is that there is a confusion for some of the taxi drivers. Some are taking it upon themselves to raise the prices and decide on whatever the price they feel like. For us who don't really know, end up paying them anyways. But even though it's expensive.
To be honest, I'm okay with it. It's pretty much the same price I've already been paying, so it hasn't really affected me personally. But I feel concerned about many others who rely on buses and taxis every day because it was very sudden.
The government approved the fare increase back in July, saying it was necessary to sustain public transport services. The 30% rise means, for example, a bus fare from Le'auva'a village to Apia has gone from 2 tala 50 cents to 3 tala 25 cents, while a taxi fare for the same route has jumped from 40 tala to 52 tala. While many passengers have criticised the rise, it's good news to taxi drivers like Fisul Tonia Bear.
Thank you to the government for this thoughtful decision for taxis and buses. I'm overjoyed because it has made our taxi work easier. This increase has now become a help for us who drive taxis, and it has greatly eased our financial burden in these difficult times. Not only that, but it's also a benefit for us taxi drivers because the old fare list had been in place for a very long time.
Fisul has been a taxi driver for over 10 years. He believes the increase is justified because of the increase in the cost of fuel due to global oil market disruptions caused by the prolonged USA and Iran conflict affecting supply routes. In Samoa, prices hit record highs in June, with petrol costing 3 tala 99 cents per litre and diesel 5 tala and 31 cents. Fisul says it's been a tough time.
The problem is the high cost of petrol, and at times passengers cannot afford the taxi fare. One person pays less while another pays more. But with petrol being so expensive for a long period before fares were raised, it was difficult. Now that fares have been increased, even though petrol prices have eased a little, the rise helps taxi drivers, including owners of taxi services and bus operators.
The fare increase has also been welcomed by bus driver Tobia Setefano. The 44-year-old says the prices should have been increased years ago.
I support the fare increase because diesel is very expensive for buses compared to petrol for taxis. For bus drivers who use buses every day and travel long distances, the higher passenger fares help offset the high cost of diesel. Over the many years I've been a bus driver, I have never heard about any fare increases, and I believe they are necessary from time to time or annually to balance the rising diesel costs we face.
He says another impact of the higher cost of fuel is that more people are travelling by bus, leading to overcrowding.
Many people use buses because given the high cost of diesel, it's cheaper for them to pay bus fares than to travel by car. But you can also see that many buses are stopped by police because they're overcrowded with passengers.
And that is Apia bus driver Tovia Setefano ending that report from Adelfrawan.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, in the world of sport, the debate over the PNG Chiefs' tax-free incentives is heating up, with critics questioning whether the new club has an unfair advantage ahead of its NRL debut in 2028. Rabbitohs coach Wayne Bennett has called the concessions unfair, while Roosters coach Trent Robinson and Penrith coach Ivan Cleary say the NRL is no longer a level playing field. But Chiefs general manager Michael Chalmers says they're taking the criticism as a badge of honour, saying it shows the new club is building a competitive team and is already being seen as a threat. And the debate has only heated up with the signing of Penrith winger Brian To'o as the Chiefs' sixth recruit.
Yeah, it is a big moment for the club to have someone of his calibre join us. While he didn't get a chance to go over, given that the seven-day deadline that was placed on him by the Panthers, he did know all about PNG from speaking to obviously us, but also over the last few months talking to Jerome about his experiences over there. So I think one thing that makes it a little bit easier is that it's not a cultural shock to him. He's a proud Samoan. He spent a lot of time in Samoa. He used to the island life. And I don't think there would be any issues with him signing with PNG. He'll be aware of what lies ahead. And he'll get a chance to see that firsthand in October when he comes over with the national team.
Mm-hmm. I think every signing like this kind of brings that renewed discussion over the Chiefs' tax-free contracts. Even Wayne Bennett has weighed in recently. I guess, what's your response to those claims that it's creating maybe an unfair playing field?
Yeah, well, look, I understand why the clubs would be saying that. They're trying to keep players. They're competing against a team that has tax-free dollars at its disposal to offer players. Now, I get that. It's not ideal for them, but everyone knew the playing conditions. Everyone knew when the Chiefs came in, it would be tax-free. It was spoken about for 12 months before it was formally announced. So we wear it as a bit of a badge of honour, to be honest with you, that clubs or people in the game feel as though this is now unfair. Well, as a club, we say that's a good reflection of the job we're doing and the roster we're assembling if they now feel threatened by what we're putting together. So that's how we're looking at it. We're looking at it as if we're doing the right thing.
How significant is that tax-free advantage, I guess, in recruitment? Realistically, could the Chiefs be competitive without it?
Oh, look, well, before I started, the NRL deemed that it was necessary for this team to be competitive, so that's why it was introduced. But I think there's a misconception out there that we have double the salary cap. That's not the case. The salary cap for us is the same as every other club. Now, what we do have the advantage, well, not us as a club, but what the players have the advantage of is earning that tax-free dollar. We as a club still operate under the same rules and the same salary cap. So there's no doubt it does help when you're negotiating with a player who may be receiving the same amount of money from another club. It does give you the edge and it gives you that incentive for other players to decide to go with the Chiefs. But that was what the game believed was necessary and what the club signed off on when they agreed to the $4 million.
Zach Lomax is currently the youngest Chiefs signing, right, at 26, but he'll be about 28 by the time they enter the NRL. I guess, does the age profile of the squad so far concern you at all?
Not at all, to be honest. I think it's a real benefit of us. We're getting seasoned pros. We're getting guys who have been successful at other clubs. I think amongst our six signings already, there are 13 premierships won between those players. So we're getting winners. We're getting players who have been around and know what it takes to be in successful environments. And then after that, it's going to be a lot easier to target the younger players because we can say to them, hey, how about coming to play with these guys? And it'd be very hard to turn down that opportunity when you see the superstar list of players we've managed to assemble.
I guess the lineup so far is a bit light on forwards. Will it be more so a priority after November 1?
Yeah, no, I've definitely heard that commentary around it. Reality is, it wasn't a tactic to go after a certain position. It's just the opportunities are around the backs at the moment. And we've got a sort of standard of play that we want to attract. Now, at the moment in the forward pack, those players aren't available until November 1. So there's no doubt come November 1 that there's going to be a real focus on forwards. But at the moment, we are not concerned one bit. I guess any forward pack would love to play with the back line that we're assembled. And to be fair, we have assembled the two of our six players. You know, Matty Lee, the front rower, and Connor Watson can play lock hooker. So there's a couple of forwards already, and we'll add to that.
Has it been confirmed yet who the feeder club is going to be? Will it be the Hunters, or is that still to be decided?
Well, the NRL hasn't decided the structure of the competitions beyond 2027. The QRL are sort of discussing what 28 looks like. So we're none the wiser at the moment as to whether there'll be the current Q Cup format as we know it. Will there be a national reserve grade? We're still waiting for clarity at the moment. So there's no doubt in the next, I'd say, 6 months, it's already started with the Hunters. We're working closely with them to make sure that we're helping those players develop and any role that we can play in helping the Hunters become a bit more competitive than they have been this year, then we want to help out because it's in our interest to help them and it's in their interest to help the Chiefs. So that partnership will be there from day one. It has been there from day one. What it looks like going forward, unfortunately, we don't have those answers yet.
And that there is PNG Chiefs General Manager Michael Chalmers speaking with our reporter Natasha Emick. Right to the Cook Islands now, where it is election day. At least 11,000 voters have registered, but as to how many will turn up to vote is a question we'll find the answer to later in the show. Another big question is whether Prime Minister Mark Brown and his Cook Island Party's vision of no one left behind, will that be enough to lead the country for another 4 years? Well, joining us this morning live from Rarotonga to give us a breakdown of today's happenings is political commentator Thomas Tarurongo. When would that say popongi mania, Thomas? Welcome back to Pacific Beat.
Yes, Pupongi Maunia. How are you all this morning?
Good, good. Thank you for joining us. I understand you are there in Rarotonga. I'm like, what is happening right now? Like, what's the atmosphere like, I suppose, as people make their way to the polling booths?
Yes, it's actually a really good feeling on voting day in the Cook Islands. People are really in a good mood. You know, they exercise their right to vote. About 7,000 out of that 11,000 will exercise their right to vote. I'm hoping that more will vote this time around, especially our younger people. That would be good to see. The Cook Island Youth Council would be more engaged in sort of connecting with our leaders and our potential candidates. So I'm really hoping for a good turnout this year. There's lots on the line this year for the vote. We're going to have two very different governments potentially going forward.
Yeah. So what do you think is at stake for these elections this year, Thomas?
Yeah, I think we're going to have a very different looking next 4 years, depending on who can constitute 13 people to get on that piece of paper and deliver that to the KR, the King's Rep. Two very different party views on things, especially around water and who should pay for it. And the other one, of course, is seabed minerals. The Cook Island United Party is looking for a referendum. Mm. They haven't outrightly said no, but they definitely want to be clearer that the people of the Cook Islands are clear that this is what they want. And the Cook Island Party, you know, is on the let's see if it's viable track. So they've already, you know, that started a good number of years ago. So two very different outcomes. The other thing I think is important to consider is that potentially Te Tiriti Hera for the Cook Island United Party would be a prime minister that would not travel as much, and he would delegate that out more. He's probably more inclined to, I think what we'd see is things sort of ring-fenced at home, and we'd see sort of a lot more concentration of what's happening at home as well as abroad. I did ask him actually when I spoke to him before, about a week ago, two ago, you know, who would be his foreign minister? That probably concerned me more than anything with the complexity of the geopolitics at the moment. And he, you know, there was somebody he highlighted, if she won her seat, that I thought was actually fit for purpose. So, yeah, you know what? Two very interestingly different Cook Islands in the next 4 years. But we'll let, you know, by 6 o'clock tonight, we'll see what the voting public have decided. And I love that. People will get out today and exercise their right to vote for the Cook Islands that they want.
Of course, yes. Okay, well, I was going to ask then, when do we expect results to come through? So you're saying around about 6 p.m. this evening, yeah?
Yeah, 6 p.m. Cook Islands time. Mm. We should start to see those numbers coming in. The scrutineers will start tallying, you know, today and once the booths close. It won't take long. I mean, we're only talking about maximum 900 in a constituency right down to 60. Or less, you know. So the question will be that the outer islands have 14 seats. Rarotonga has 10. So the outer islands generally hold the balance of power.
I was going to say, how important is the outer islands very, in this election?
Very, 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 very important. I mean, we've got, I think some of the hot seats at the moment would be Manihiki, Pukapuka, Penryn. Those are hot seats. And then, you know, we want to see what's going to happen in Mangaia. They've got an independent that's won already because she's uncontested. There's another independent there. Plus, there's a Democratic Party seat. The other thing happening this year is, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens to the Democratic Party.
Right.
As a party, as a whole, because, you know, worst case scenario for the Cook Island United Party under Te Tiriti Hera is he could become the new opposition.
I mean, would that surprise you when the final results come through?
That wouldn't surprise me, no. It wouldn't surprise me that the Cook Island United Party have enough wins to, worst case scenario for them is for them to be in opposition and he becomes the leader of the opposition, which will make a very interesting next 4 years if that happens also. So I think either way, we're going to have a very dynamic outcome. Either way, we're going to have a very dynamic next 4 years.
Mm.
And, you know, with the stuff happening with American Samoa at the moment, with seabed minerals and the contesting of spaces that have material minerals, that feed semiconductors and the war machine and other things, you know, that's a contested space. So interesting. It's going to be very interesting.
Well, I know from our last conversation, we did talk about, you know, cost of living appears to be that major concern, right, for voters. So again, for today, how much, again, will that influence people's votes today?
Mm. Major concern. Yeah, major concern. Major concern, power, water, phone, internet, food, petrol. Major concern. You know, the other. Sometimes I do think the other topics that politicians grapple with, but I'm not so sure that when someone's sitting at the polling booth and they've actually hopped on their bike, they've looked at the gas tank and driven up to the polling booth and then gone back and thought, what will we have for lunch today, and what's in the cupboard, that some of those larger issues will be front and centre for them. You know, it'll be more the stuff that is affecting them each and every day. And, you know, it's expensive to live in the Cook Islands. It's more expensive, of course, because of freight. And we get by. I mean, I lived on, you know, living there, I lived on a quarter of what I earn at the moment. But I lived well. You know, it's an interesting economy. I don't think you can say, oh, you only earn that much, or the minimum wage is this, and so how do you live like that? Well, I actually think we live well. You know, like I never ever felt like we went without. I really didn't. You know, but you just, maybe I didn't have as many pairs of shoes. That's right.
No need for shoes, Thomas, if you're in the islands. I want to ask though, you know, if there's the possibility, right, if neither major party secures a clear majority, what happens next then? Like, could the smaller parties or independents maybe hold that balance of power?
Well, like, if you look at the last two or three elections, no major party has had enough to run. So we have had coalition governments for the last three elections. That is going to happen. The independents are going to be the kingmakers. There is a way the major parties will get to 13, and that's not going to be by themselves. And so the horse trading will begin almost immediately once the tallies are in. And then negotiations will be happening by phone to the independents, and they will be making it clear what they want out of that negotiation. And whoever can come up with the best constituted offer will get 13 names on a piece of paper. They'll make their way down to the King's representative, and they'll say, we can form a government. The only thing to take into account there also is we will have electoral petitions. Those happen every year, every election. And so there will be electorates that will be taken to court where they will determine whether everything that happened in that election cycle was kosher or not. Mm. You know, and electorates have been tipped by buying people lunch.
Of course.
You know, we're talking about really small things like, you know, like purchasing lunch, who paid for the beers, you know, who paid for the barbecue. Literally, it's cartons of chicken. We're talking about things like that. So so those things will play out also. So we may not see the result, the end result, for a little bit longer, I think. You know, I'd probably put it out maybe even 4 weeks from now, after the election cycle is done, after the votes are in, after the – because we had a number of seats that changed also with the special votes. So those need to come in also. There'll be votes coming in from Australia, votes coming in from New Zealand.
Yes, which reminds me also, have you yourself been able to cast your vote already?
No, I don't qualify. I needed to live there for three months residence to qualify. So I don't qualify. Okay. So I'm a UN observer.
Well, look,
I have asked as many people as I can how they are going to vote. So, you know, people are pretty clear about who they're going to vote for.
Absolutely. Look, that's all the time we have for this morning, Thomas. I mean, it is great that we've been able to catch up and really just see, you know, how this is going to unravel. And as you say, those results won't come through till about 6 p.m. tonight, Cook Islands time. So we look forward to probably getting an update from you again after
that. Yeah, no, let's do that. Yes. Let's do that. All right.
Me taki, Thomas.
Yeah, me taki mata.
Thank you. Bye. That, of course, is Cook Island political commentator Thomas Tarurongo Wynn here on Pacific Beat. Finally, in 1904, British anthropologists produced the earliest films of Papua New Guinea. The silent black and white films record traditional dances performed by men and women from communities along coastal areas near PNG's capital, Port Moresby, which was at the time just a small outpost with fewer than 50 residents. Now efforts are underway to reconnect the descendants of those in the film, which hopes it would provide insight into the dances and culture of pre-modern PNG. Whenua Whenua spoke to one of the organisers of number one Big Belong Papua New Guinea project, Professor Don Niles from the Australian National University.
Their work was focused around the southern coast of what was then British New Guinea, and most of the things that they filmed concerned dance. So of the films that they made, there are 20 films, 20 dances that are filmed that have survived until today. However, these films have not been researched before, and certainly the communities, descendants of the performers in these 1904 films would know nothing about these films. In contrast to some other ethnographic films made in other parts of the world, these are very, very little known. So these films have been restored by the British Film Institute. They've been digitized. They've been shared with us and the National Film Institute in Goroka here. We'll be beginning work with these materials. We're going to be looking for researchers from the six language groups that are recorded, that are represented by the dances. We want speakers of those languages so the researchers can bring these early films back to the communities concerned, play them for people, try to get the reactions, what's similar, what's different. I think it should be very interesting. Keep in mind, these are black and white films. There's no sound, and they're, most of them are very short. However, there are many things visually that should be of interest in addition to the dances themselves, of course, the decorations the performers are using, the locations at which these films were recorded, the kinds of things that may be common today that are not present in the films. A lot of things that I think people could be very interested in and could reflect upon in seeing these films.
Okay? This film project, could you describe it? What's the purpose?
It's a project funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council in the UK. It's hosted jointly by the London School of Economics and the Institute of Papua New Guinea Studies. The project lead is at the London School of Economics, Michael Scott, and the co-lead, Naomi Fike-Semet, is at the Institute of Papua New Guinea Studies here in Port Moresby. Vicky Bonnicott is a research associate in London, and I'm a research associate at the Institute. So it's a collaborative project between these two institutions, but also involving the British Film Institute, where the original films have been archived, as well as Papua New Guinea's own National Film Institute, the British Museum, Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology in Cambridge, and so forth.
Does it show that the dances have changed?
Well, it's a bit early to say that, since the people who will be exploring that are in the process of being sought, and they will be hired to investigate such things. But in immediately our looking at the films, certainly some of the dances look very different from the kinds of things one would generally see at festivals today from those that part of the country in Papua New Guinea. Some things that look quite different, some things certainly do look similar, but we're not in a position to say yet how different they are. Some of these are maybe traditions that are no longer performed for whatever reasons. Maybe some of them are still performed, but they're not as popular as other dances that are showcased when festivals take place. It's too early in the process to determine what the situation is, but that's why I think there's a lot in the films that should be both familiar, but also perhaps surprising. And we very much look forward to the kind of comments we get from people in the village today when they see these films.
What motivated the expedition to go out there and film these dances? Was it because of concerns that the culture may be lost and they wanted to keep it recorded?
I think a variety of reasons. In 1898, when Seligman came to the Torres Strait, they were very much concerned about the fact that many cultural traditions were probably being lost in the Torres Strait. So maybe this would have been a concern for Seligman in his return here. I think also when Seligman visited in 1898, he got some idea of the tremendous diversity of cultural expressions here. He may have seen some of these dances before and felt that the only way to really document these dances is with film, that a photograph or a written description simply isn't sufficient to properly document these films. So I think he wanted to take advantage of this new technology that was available to researchers in making film.
And that there is Professor Don Niles from the Australian National University. Well, that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at some of our main stories today. Destroyed crops, hungry children and empty schools are the impacts of El Nino spreading across the highlands of Papua New Guinea.
If it continues, the kids might lose life or we might have affected by disease.
Again, could the untapped gas fields in PNG change the way energy is supplied?
To have a source that's in the Asia-Pacific region, which is a stable region, it's a region at peace, is very attractive. So that will help this project.
And there is a good feeling at this year's Cook Islands general elections. Our results will be known by 6 p.m. tonight, Cook Island time. Now you can find some of those top stories if you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Our team will be back tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned because your news is next, and coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, o toa o whātua, this is Pacific Beat. Yours in the Pacific.